The following is a lecture on Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 9, given by His Holiness Gopal Krishna Goswami.
Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihare. Gopi jana bala bha Ivala dhari Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya Om Gyante Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakya Chakshuran Militanyena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manovestam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru, Shri Uta Pada Kamalan, Shri Gurun Vaishnavamsta, Shri Lupam Sagrajatam, Sahagana Ragunathan Mitam Tham Sajevam, Sadvetam Sabadhutam, Paijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam, Shri Radha Krishna Padan, Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamsha He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dhina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesa Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shiva Shri Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna
Hare Krishna Krishna Hare Hare
All of you may have noticed that even thou There is information on different types of yoga, etc. The theme or the emphasis in Krishna's instructions to Arjuna is on the path of devotion. The path of devotion, which is based upon sense control and focusing the mind at the lotus feet of the Lord. Today we shall discuss chapter 9, which is called The Most Confidential Knowledge. So, chapter 9, The Most Confidential Knowledge, starts with the Supreme Lord explaining the qualifications and the disqualifications for obtaining knowledge about Him. Just like in every sphere, you have to have some qualifications, isn't it? So even to understand the Lord, you need some qualifications. It is not that you can just stop anyone on the road and ask him information about God. Our tragedy is that with regards to anything personal, we want to go to a personalist or specialist. Just like when there's something wrong with you, you want to go to the right doctor. You're not just going to catch anyone on the road and tell him, please operate me or tell what's wrong with me. But when it comes to religion, without discrimination, we'll just catch any sadhu or any old man and ask him, please tell me, what is real religion? And because we are going to the non-experts or non-specialists for information, we are unable to obtain proper information about religion. So Krishna says, because you're never envious of me, I shall impart this knowledge to you. And by obtaining this knowledge, you'll be relieved from the miseries of material existence. We had discussed in the verse yesterday from the 8th chapter how Krishna has listed two characteristics that indicate nothing but misery, and further that everything is temporary. Dukhalayam ashashvatam. So Krishna is saying that I'm giving this knowledge to you because you're not envious of me. And by understanding this transcendental knowledge, you will be able to become free from the miseries of material existence. So there should be no doubt in anyone's mind that material existence means nothing but misery. And if the leaders of society make us believe that they have an arrangement to make us feel happy, any sane man should know that this is a false statement. Just like if somebody was to tell you that he has found water in the desert, you're not going to believe it. So certainly when you have Krishna the creator, and in this chapter again we will see Krishna explaining how he creates this universe, if the creator himself is saying that this world is nothing but a place of misery, how can we conclude, no, there is nothing but happiness. So Krishna is explaining that the main reason why Arjuna was selected to be the recipient of this great science was because of his one qualification. He was a devotee. Arjuna was not a sannyasi. He was a householder, like all of you probably are. But this was his qualification. He was not envious of the Lord. He was not envious of the Lord, and he was a devotee of the Lord. Hence, we understand that if we wish to obtain information about the Bhagavad Gita, we too should turn to somebody who has the same mentality that Arjuna had towards Krishna. Then Krishna goes on to explain in this chapter the characteristics of this transcendental knowledge. In the verses that we discussed yesterday and day before, we discussed some of the characteristics of Krishna, isn't it? But in this second verse of this chapter, Krishna gives us a glimpse of the characteristics of this transcendental knowledge. What does he say? Raja Vidya Raja Guhyam Pavitram Idam Uttamam Pratyakshavagamam Dharmyam Susukham Kartam Avyayam. He says, first of all, that this knowledge is the king of education, Raja Vidya. So we are obtaining knowledge in schools, colleges. We are not far from Bombay University. In Bombay University, there are so many departments of education. But actually, there is no department that tells you what happens after death, isn't it? Now, this knowledge is called the king of education, superior to knowledge that you can obtain in any part of the world, including the best universities of the world, because this knowledge enables one to obtain real happiness. And this knowledge enables one to end the miseries of life, which cannot be avoided by any other means. So, one characteristic of this knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita is that it is the king of education. Another characteristic is Raja Guhyam. It is confidential. In other words, this knowledge can be understood through the means of a devotee. This is revealed by the Lord to his devotee. And if we are fortunate enough to obtain this knowledge from the right source, then we stand to gain. Pavitram, this is another characteristic of this transcendental knowledge. Pavitram means it is the purest. Now, we've often explained in our discourses that one of the characteristics of the Lord is that he is the purest, isn't it? Why do we take to the process of chanting? Why do we take to the process of associating with saintly personalities, etc.? Because the impure senses cannot comprehend the pure personality. And in order to take away the poison from the senses, we need a medicine. Just like you take away the germs from the body in a diseased condition, you need a medicine. So that medicine is the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. So, by taking the spiritual medicine, we are able to appreciate this purest personality. Another reason why this knowledge is addressed as pure is because the Supreme does not suffer from the four types of defects that each of us suffers from. He never makes any mistakes. He doesn't get illusion. There is no tendency to cheat. There's absolutely no tendency. So this knowledge is called Pavitram because this is the purest knowledge. And anyone who takes advantage of this knowledge can also become pure. Then Uttamam. Uttamam means transcendental. This is not mundane knowledge. It is transcendental, beyond the influence of the material modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. And this transcendental knowledge can enable us to understand the transcendental personality of Godhead, who, as we will see again in this chapter, is beyond the material modes. Pratyaksha. Pratyaksha means by direct experience. So we practice this knowledge, we can feel it. Very often people tell us, can you show me God? The question is, do we have the eyes to see God? People won't even experiment with the process that we advocate, and they will falsely conclude this process will not work. Just like if somebody was to show you a bottle of honey and tell you that a bottle contains sweet honey inside, for you to believe it, you literally have to taste it, isn't it? Unless you taste it, you don't know whether the honey is going to work or not, whether it's sweet or not. Similarly, you have to experience this knowledge. But you can only experience it if you follow the path. So you can directly experience this knowledge. And susukham, this is another characteristic. It is very happily performed. In other words, we should not think that by taking to the spiritual path, in any way one will be deprived of happiness. Basically, we're all searching for happiness. There is no denial that those who pursue the path of spiritual life, they are also searching for happiness. And those who have not joined us in coming here, and at the bars or gambling casinos or wherever, they're also searching for happiness. But the happiness that you obtain by material activity is a short term. At any time, it can end. But the happiness you obtain in serving the Lord is permanent and real. So Krishna is explaining in this verse, susukham, that it is very happily executed. It is very happily executed, this transcendental knowledge. So Krishna explains the transcendental characteristics of this great knowledge, and if we can just appreciate the greatness of this knowledge, then we can take advantage of it. But if one is doubtful, and as Krishna says in the Gita, for the doubting soul, there's no happiness now or later. So therefore, we must understand the greatness of this knowledge and accept this knowledge in the same spirit that Krishna wants us to accept Him. So Krishna says, those who are not faithful, as we said at the commencement of our lecture, in the first three verses, Krishna is pointing out the qualification and the disqualification for understanding Him. So we have listed the qualification. One who is not envious of Him, and then he can understand this knowledge. And we've also listed the transcendental characteristics of this knowledge. But Krishna goes on to say that those who are not faithful on this path, they cannot attain me. Those who are not faithful to Krishna's instructions, they cannot cross over the cycle of birth and death. The cycle of birth and death is a very, very painful process. But one cannot cross over the cycle of birth and death with an envious attitude. So there's nothing to gain in being envious of the position of the Supreme Lord. Our faith in the Supreme Lord is developed by what is known as the process of sadhana bhakti. The process of sadhana bhakti means there's certain rules and regulations that you have to follow in order to increase your faith in the Supreme Lord and His instructions. Faith can be of three types. Sometimes you may have somebody who is doing devotional service, but he doesn't have sound knowledge of the scriptures. So you can see in that condition, his faith is weak, or of the third category. Then you may have another individual who may be versed in the scriptures, but not very well versed. And at the same time, is executing devotional service. Now this person's faith could be of the second type, because even though he's not very well versed in the scriptures, still he has faith that devotional service is something to be executed in the human form of life. And the first type of faith is when one is well versed in the scriptural knowledge, and the conclusion of the scriptural knowledge is that devotional service is the only practical path. So when you have this scriptural knowledge, and at the same time you execute devotional service in a practical manner, then it is said in that condition our faith is the best of the three. So in the first two situations, the likelihood of staying on the path of devotion is very strong. But at the third level, where one does not have scriptural knowledge, and at the same time one is not very convinced about devotional service, even though one may have commenced the path of devotional service, at any time it can be interrupted on some pretext or the other. Therefore, if we take to the process of following some rules and regulations, then you can advance or build up your faith and come to the second level of faith, or even the first level, depending upon how hard we endeavor. Just like in any material field, based on how you endeavor, you obtain success, isn't it? For business, you people have to work very hard. On a job, when you want a promotion, you have to work very hard. So similarly, even on the spiritual path, there has to be some endeavor. To hold the view that we can do our devotion whenever I have time is not very respectful to the position of the Almighty Lord. But to hold the view that this is the most important activity, first things first, and around that our other activities are regulated, that is more important. So the different levels of faith, and scriptural knowledge is highly recommended, because scriptural knowledge is what convinces you to understand the importance of the path of devotion. One of the problems we see in this country is, and not only in this country, all over the planet, is people don't really understand the scriptures. There are very few people who are presenting the scriptures in a pure light. And as a result, nobody really understands what is real dharma. In the name of dharma, everything that what you see is nothing but adharma. Now, after establishing the qualifications and disqualifications for understanding Krishna, Krishna proceeds to give us a further glimpse about this material creation of his, how he is the cause of all causes. One thing we wish to remind you, that even though this theme has already been established in the earlier chapters, that Krishna is the cause of all causes, nevertheless Krishna keeps repeating it in order to emphasize that he is the cause of all causes, and repetition is necessary in order to drive the point home. So Krishna says, by me in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not a part of this cosmic manifestation, for myself is the very source of creation. So, it is being explained that Krishna is all-pervading, just like the sun is all-pervading, isn't it? Wherever you go, you see the influence of the sun. And he is not conceivable by material senses. And just because the Lord is all-pervasive does not mean that he does not have his personal spiritual form. The reason why we at times conclude that the Lord does not have his personal form is because we are trying to understand the Supreme Lord through our own material senses. But the Supreme can never be understood through our own material senses. Our spiritual master used to give an example to show Krishna being all-pervasive by stating, just like, for example, you have a king of a kingdom. There's so many departments. The influence of the king is there in all the departments, isn't it? He doesn't have to be present over there, but it's all, his influence is all-pervasive in his kingdom. But the king does not have to be personally present in every department. So Krishna, or the Supreme Lord, is all-pervasive in the cause of this creation. And even though he is the cause, even though he is all-pervasive, everything, he is the source of this entire creation, it should be understood that he has a personal form. Therefore, we see everywhere in the Bhagavad Gita, it says Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, very clearly. And in the 12th chapter, we will see this again, when Arjuna questions Krishna as to what path is superior, meditating on your personal form or impersonal. Krishna very straightforwardly concludes, meditation on my personal form is far superior. So in the Vedic scripture that is said that the Supreme cannot be understood through our material senses. Athasha Krishna Namadi na bhaved grahem indriyahi se vo mukhehi jiva dos svayam eva spurat yadaha. It says in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that one cannot understand the Lord through one's material senses. But if we are fortunate enough to take to the path of devotion, then we can understand the Supreme Lord. And some of you may have seen pictures of Atlas holding the globe, isn't it? But if you remarked of that picture where Atlas is holding the globe, you may have noted that Atlas really looks exhausted. You know, you can see wrinkles on his cheeks, and just like when you're traveling with heavy baggage, you're just anxious to put the baggage or get it off your hand, isn't it? So that's exactly how it looks with Atlas holding the world. But you don't see that in the Krishna's case. For example, you've even seen pictures of Krishna holding the Govardhan Hill. You don't see Krishna being fatigued at all or getting tired at all. And in fact, when Krishna was carrying the Govardhan Hill, all the inhabitants who took shelter of the umbrella of Govardhan, none of them even felt hunger and thirst. Just imagine. So when we talk about God, we talk about God as one who is in possession of transcendental qualities. Now, Krishna gives us a very nice example to show his mystic opulences. Krishna says, just like the wind. Now the wind is everywhere, isn't it? You may have tall skyscrapers. In some parts of the world you have 100, 120 story buildings. But nothing is taller than the wind, isn't it? Because even if you go, even if you fly 100,000 feet above the ground, even if you go above the clouds, well above the clouds, still the wind is there, isn't it? So Krishna says, just like the wind is blowing everywhere, but still it is contained within what? What is it contained within? Within the sky. So Krishna says, just like the wind, which is all pervasive, is contained within the sky. So similarly he says that all created beings actually rest in me. Such a beautiful example, isn't it? So we have a material situation where you have the wind everywhere, but still it is contained within something, which is the sky. Why is it not possible for all created beings to be there, to rest in Krishna? Certainly it is possible. So by Krishna's will, this creation is manifested and again it is destroyed. Yesterday we had discussed about Brahma's life, and we had explained how even Brahma's life, now Brahma lives for 311 trillion and 40 billion of our earthly years. Just to recap, just to remind you, Brahma's one day is equal to 1,000 ages taken together. And 1,000 ages means Satya Yuga, 18 lakh years, Treta Yuga, 13 lakh, Dwapara Yuga, 8.5 lakh, and Kali Yuga, 4.3 lakhs. Add this up, multiply it by 1,000, and that is equal to Brahma's one day. And again, that is Brahma's one night. And Brahma lives for only 100 years. So 100 years may not appear that great, but these are Brahma's years. But after that, even Brahma has to die. So it doesn't matter how high one may elevate oneself, everything is temporary. So Krishna says at the end of the millennium. When Krishna says the end of the millennium, it means end of Brahma's life. Krishna says at the end of the millennium, all material manifestations enter into my nature. And at the beginning of another millennium, by my potency, I again create. So Krishna creates this universe, and then it is destroyed at a certain point in time, and then again, it is created again. And Krishna confirms, the whole cosmic order is working under my will. It is automatically manifested again and again, under my will, it is annihilated. So we should carefully understand that everything is temporary. Why is Krishna again pointing out that by his will it is created and annihilated? Because Krishna again wants to point out our plans to live on this planet eternally are futile. Even Brahma could not live on this. When Hiranyakashipu requested Brahma to be obtained the benediction that he may never die, Brahma, being a genuine devotee of the Lord, frankly confessed that even he is going to die, so where is the question of his being able to give that benediction to somebody else? So Krishna is pointing out, again, confirming the statement that he's made in the 8th chapter, that everything is ashashvata. Ashashvata means that everything is temporary. So Krishna is confirming again by showing that in the end of the millennium, the whole show is going to end in any case. So we must understand that everything is actually temporary. And we must also understand that Krishna as the creator is always detached from everything that's going on. In other words, we cannot say that if there's something bad happening to somebody, then that bad thing is happening because God is not looking after him, or God is not doing his duty. Like very often people come up to us and they say, if God is there, then why are people starving in Ethiopia? Why are people starving in that part of the world? Why is this happening? Why is that happening? We have to understand that material nature works according to certain laws. But that does not mean that the Lord is personally responsible. Just like, for example, you may have a high court judge. Now, the high court judge may be passing various sentences based upon the criminal record of different individuals that come up before him. One man may be hanged, another may get a 1-year sentence, somebody else may get a 2-day sentence or whatever, isn't it? But it doesn't mean that the high court judge is a crook, criminal, stone-hearted man because one man is being sentenced to be hanged, isn't it? Because based on the laws of the land, all that the high court judge does is just determine what punishment is due to him. So that we must understand that Krishna is detached from all this, but still everything is working under his supervision. Maya dakshena prakati suiti sachara charam hetu nanena kantya jagav vipari vartate. So Krishna is saying, this material nature is working under my direction. Now in this verse, Krishna is more or less summarizing the 4 or 5 previous verses in which he is establishing that he is the creator of this cosmic manifestation. Krishna is saying, this material nature is working under my direction. So our scientists would like us to believe that the material nature is working under their direction, isn't it? The scientists would like us to believe that they are calling the shots, not Krishna. For example, foolishly, scientists have been experimenting for the past 10-15 years how they can create artificial clouds and produce rain. Now, there's a very scientific logic that explains how rains are obtained. If you remember, we had discussed this logic when we were discussing the 3rd chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. When we were discussing the 3rd chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, we discussed a verse which explained the following. Anabhavanti bhutani prajanat anna sambhava. That in this verse, Krishna says, food grains are coming from rainfall. And rainfall is coming from sacrifice. Sacrifice means executing religious duty. So if you don't do religious duties, then you will find that Prakriti will refuse to cooperate. Just like in Vedic history, once upon a time, there was a king called Vena. The present-day rulers could be compared to King Vena, because King Vena had all the powers in his hand, and he was completely godless. He did not want to take the advice of the real Brahmanas. These days, of course, you don't even have real Brahmanas to advise. But anyway, when they were real Brahmanas, King Vena was very proud, and he was godless. And he did not even want his citizens to do any type of yajna. So, as a result, the citizens were very unhappy. And there came a point when even Prakriti refused to cooperate. Because the king was godless and he was stopping the people from doing yajna. The trees stopped to give the fruits. The earth stopped to release the grains. And very soon the people were starving and they were in complete agony and misery. Then his son Prithu became the king. And when he became the king, the citizens came up to him and said, "Sir, it's your duty as our king to take care of our basic necessities of life. Now please give us roti, kapra and makan, huh? Please give us our food to eat and a place to stay and so on." So the king said, "There's nothing that I can do. But I know that if you go and glorify the Lord by chanting his names, then all the necessary resources will be supplied." So Prakriti cooperates with us in proportion to our cooperation with the laws of the Lord. Today we have a situation where, you see, countries either get floods or drought. Either it's if the rainfall is good or there's a complete drought. Or there are always some calamities in some part of the world or the other. So this is because there is somebody else controlling this Prakriti. And that somebody else is Krishna, the personality of Godhead. It is not if the sun rises every day at the right time. There's nobody who claims credit for that. There is somebody who's supervising the work of the sun also. So Krishna says, my Prakriti. For example, today you have a world situation where certain countries are very rich and certain countries are poor and some at the middle level and so on, isn't it? Now frankly, even those countries which are very rich, they are rich because they have the resources which Prakriti has given them, isn't it? It is not that the resources that that country claims have been put over there by the founding fathers of the country or by the party in power or whatever. It was put over there by Prakriti. And even, for example, this microphone, which is a result of modern technology, this is there because they have taken the resources provided by the Lord, manipulated it in an appropriate manner, and produces microphone. Even if you have something synthetic, eventually it is all coming from one of the products, that is from oil, isn't it? Oil is one of the ingredients, even for producing something artificial. So, ultimately, everything is coming from the Lord. But unfortunately, all that we know is how to manipulate the resources of God and claim all the credit. Just like we say, everyone talks about Japanese technology, Japanese this, but all that they're doing, they're just manipulating the resources that they either import or produce, and they manipulate it in a manner that we think is very appealing. So the point to understand is that the resources are all being provided by God. All that we are able to do is just manipulate the resources provided by God. Now Krishna says, unfortunately, there are some people who deride the idea of his supremacy. Just like even when Krishna was present, there were people who didn't accept him as God, isn't it? Even now, all of you who are sitting here are very fortunate, you accept Krishna as God, but there are many people who don't accept Krishna as God, isn't it? So he says, avajanti ma mura manasem thanam ashratam param bhavan aginanto mama bhuta maheshwaram. He says, fools deride me when I appear in this human form. They do not know my transcendental nature as the Supreme Lord of all that be. So Krishna has already explained, even in the fourth chapter, how he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But unfortunately, they don't understand. Even after getting so many direct instructions directly from Krishna, still they have the audacity to conclude that God doesn't have a personal form. And not only that, even when they translate Krishna's instructions, they distort it. How insulting, isn't it? How offended do each of you feel? Suppose you are sending a message to your son at another location, and you tell your friend, please tell my son, this is my message. And the person you're sending the message through, he distorts the message or adds in his 2 cents, 2 paisa, his opinion. So, and then when you find out that the message that was conveyed of yours was distorted, won't you feel offended? Am I right, Vinod? Suppose you're sending a message to Mr. Venugopal and somebody adds on his 2 phrases. Won't you feel insulted? Isn't it? So, and we do it all the time with Krishna's instructions. Take Krishna's words and add on our opinion. And we think that Krishna will not be offended. Sure, he will be offended. So Krishna is saying that those who don't understand him, they are actually fools. And he says, Mogasha moga karmano moga jnana vicheta saha. And these fools are attracted by demonic and atheistic views. And in that condition, their hopes for liberation totally fade away. Now, this refers to those who may even study the Bhagavad Gita, for example. They may even translate the Bhagavad Gita, for example. But if they have not translated the Bhagavad Gita in the same spirit that Krishna has spoken the Bhagavad Gita, then they cannot get the benefit, isn't it? Krishna is saying in this verse that their hopes for liberation will go away. That means they may have the knowledge. They may be very well versed in Sanskrit. They may be Sanskrit pundits. They may have written volumes of books on Sanskrit. But if they are not translating Krishna properly, then they are influenced by demonic views and their hopes for liberation will totally fade away. So Krishna is telling us very clearly in these 2 verses that we should not be in a position where we deride his superior form, or we should not be in a position where we don't accept him as he is. In other words, Krishna is telling us we should accept him like Arjuna accepted him without any envy at all. Why is it that some people don't surrender to God? Because they want to be God's competitor. Krishna is declared as a supreme enjoyer. So if we serve the Supreme Lord, just like when you serve the stomach, the different organs of the body are nourished, you automatically get satisfied. But people want to be God's competitor, and therefore we see that they don't surrender to the Supreme Lord. So even though they may say, no, I'm not envious of God, but within their heart there is deep-rooted envy. And because of the deep-rooted envy, they're unable to surrender to the Supreme Lord. After describing the demonic mentality of those who don't surrender, Krishna proceeds to describe who is a great personality. In our country, we use the word Mahatma very cheaply. Some man does some great work, we say, oh, look at that great Mahatma. But Krishna's definition of Mahatma is as follows. Mahatmanastu mam partha devim praktim ashrutaha bhajantyanana manaso gyatva butadim avyayam. He says, those who are not deluded, the great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, the Mahatma is one who is always engaged in chanting the names of the Lord, serving the Lord with great determination, bowing down before him, and they worship the Lord with devotion. So the Mahatma is not somebody who may have done some big political act. The Mahatma is not someone who may have done some heroic act. But the Mahatma is the one who is one with the teachings of the Lord. The Mahatma is one who has embraced the teachings of the Lord. And one who has embraced the teachings of the Lord, he is naturally living in accordance with the desires of the Lord, who is naturally living with the wishes of the Lord. So we must understand this. A Mahatma cannot just be anyone. We can't just accept a famous personality and make him a Mahatma. You don't make Mahatmas by rubber stamping people. The Mahatma has to generally manifest these qualities that Krishna has listed. One thing we notice in the scriptures that we have complete information on all aspects of knowledge. For example, even in the discussion that we had so far, we've read about the characteristics of the law, the characteristics of the spiritual knowledge, Now we hear the characteristics of one who is a Mahatma. So we must understand that the Supreme Lord is the cause of all causes, and one who surrenders to Him is actually the true Mahatma. Now Krishna goes on to explain how there's a class of people known as the Mayavadis that we often refer to, who actually don't recognize His personal form. So actually, that is very, very tragic. There's some who don't recognize His personal form, and some want to worship Him, some want to worship God, thinking that they can become one with the Lord. So Krishna says, who engage in the cultivation of knowledge and worship the Supreme Lord as the one without a second, as diverse in many and in the universal form. So Krishna is telling Arjuna that actually those who just cultivate this knowledge and they don't really understand Him as one all-pervasive who is present everywhere, actually they are actually also very, very unfortunate. So Krishna is describing in the next few verses how He is manifesting Himself in different ways. He says, I'm the ritual, I'm the sacrifice, the offering to the ancestors, the healing herb, the transcendental chant, I'm the butter and the fire and the offering. I'm the father of this universe, the mother, the support and the grandchild. I'm the object of knowledge, the purifier and the several om. I'm also the Rig, Sama and Yajurvedas. So through His various energies, Krishna manifests Himself as a very important aspect of our existence. Krishna in these verses is explaining how He's manifesting Himself as very important aspect of our existence. He says, I'm the sacrifice, even the offering to the ancestors, the transcendental chant, the father of the universe, and these Vedas, this is all I. So Krishna in these verses is giving us a glimpse of how He's manifesting Himself. Actually, if you recall, we also had a glimpse in the verses we read in the chapter yesterday of Krishna manifests Himself through His different energies. Like He says, I'm the taste of water, isn't it? I'm the light of the sun. I'm the chanting of the Omkara mantra. So Krishna, through these verses, is revealing to us how He's manifesting Himself in different aspects of our existence. And everyone's goal is Krishna. Whatever people may approach the other demigods also, for example, for something. But actually one who is in complete knowledge understands that even what the demigods are actually giving is actually coming from Him. So Krishna says, I'm the goal, the sustainer, the master, the witness, the abode, the refuge, and the most dear friend. So we must understand that actually there's no one more dear than the Supreme Lord. The Supreme Lord is actually our most dear friend. There's a great Vaishnava poet, and in one prayer he has written, he says, Ami bina bandhu nahi ke ache tumara. O conditioned soul, you may think that you have many, many friends, but actually nobody is your friend but me. Because your only real friend is one who cares for you to terminate the cycle of birth and death. One actually who is always anxious to obtain some benefit from you is not your real friend. So Krishna says, I am the most dear friend. So Krishna through these verses has established what? He's established that He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Hare Krishna.